Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Strange Dominions Podcast, where we try and bridge the gap between the paranormal and the occult, the esoteric and the supernatural, and the unseen and the unknown. I'm your host, Octavian Graves, and this is episode 10 of Strange Dominions, and it's a very interesting episode because we've only been around for 2 months at this point, and we've already had 1,000 downloads, which is insane to me. I never thought that was going to happen so quickly, and it has. And it's entirely because of you, the listener. We would not be where we are right now if it wasn't for you sharing the show, enjoying the show, talking about the show, reviewing the show. You know, all of that goes a long way to help us out and to put us in the ears of other people. So we really, really want to thank you for that. I think you're really going to like this one. This is our interview with Mike Warsnick, who is a painter, but also an experiencer of Bigfoot. Bigfoot is a very big deal to me, and I've been wanting to incorporate Bigfoot into the show in some way multiple times since we started it, but it hasn't really presented itself in a very clear-cut way until now. And it's a big part of this one because he's had 3 sightings in 2 years, which even when he discussed it with the BFRO, the Bigfoot Researchers Organization, after his 3rd encounter, they said it was prophetic how many he has had in such a short amount of time. So we're going to be talking with him about his encounters, his paintings, and how he integrates Bigfoot into his paintings, which he does in a very big way, as well as some other strange encounters he's had with something he doesn't know what it is. If you have seen something strange or unusual, such as a cryptid, a spirit, a fae, a sea monster, or anything in between, send us an email at strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com and you could be on the show. Same goes for if you are a practitioner of the esoteric arts or the occult and you have had strange occurrences regarding your practice. Send us an email at strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com and you can be on the show to talk about it. Our Patreon is up. We have an episode on there already. There is also pins, patches, and stickers for the varying tiers. The smallest one is $4 a month, and with that you just get the exclusive content and the extra episodes, and it goes up by $4 a month based on what you want with your package. So with all that said, we are going to jump right into the interview. So here is my discussion with Mark Warsnick, the painter. All right, tonight I am speaking with Mike Warsnick, who is a painter and also a Bigfoot experiencer. How you doing, Mike?
Good.
Did I get your last name right?
Warsnick, yeah. Some of my relatives have actually come up with some kind of transformation to Lawrence. For some reason, I don't know how they do that.
Oh, that's interesting.
It means Lawrence.
Some people, you know, they kind of come up with their own versions of people's names. A lot of people that do that to me, too.
We do it by law of averages or something with other names in other societies and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Polish and different names, but I say Warsnick, but some people say Warsniak.
Well, when I called you before, I went to your voicemail and I heard you say Warsnick, so that's how I'm just going to say it. So
yeah, it's definitely hard to say when you have a cold. If you have a cold, that's when it starts to change.
Okay, that's good to know. So you're a painter, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right, so how long have you been painting?
I started painting when I was about 12. Oh, yeah, when I got my first art kits and stuff like that. I had a little drawing contest with my dad when I was about 9, and I started drawing a lot after that, and I got into making up my own scenes, like Thanksgiving scenes and stuff like that. I've got one where I'm pulling out a .45 automatic, shooting at some Indians, and there's a bunch of them coming to the table, and it's just a lot of little story time type things that kids hear, and they draw little pretty neat little drawings, you know, for a little 12-year-old kid. It surprised me.
Oh, yeah, of course. So you mostly did landscapes when you first started out, is that correct? And scenes?
Yeah, well, when I got into selling it, I leaned towards basically wildlife art. I did a few pets, and I always have done a few pets for people because that's just something that they demanded. But if I could do wildlife, you know, I can do pets. But portraits were really hard for me as far as getting the facial features. They were really hard for me for years and years. And I did some people like Indians and stuff like that from history, Army, Civil War, stuff like that. But they never really, really were a favorite of mine until here recently. I've gotten a lot better at doing people than I was before.
That's awesome. I know that portraits, that's kind of an advanced art as far as painting goes from what I have encountered. I have an interest in, I'm not a visual artist, but I do have a great love of art, and I enjoy a lot of the classical landscapes and landscape paintings of the 18 and early 1900s. So I've seen your art, and it's amazing, but there's a very specific aspect to your art that makes you very unique, and that is that you paint Bigfoot in a lot of your landscapes. Is that correct?
Yeah, I have kind of a, I don't know, my art is not really what you call surrealistic, but when you see my artwork, most people that know me can recognize my style, but at the same time, it's a realistic style, but it has kind of an atmospheric, wide open feeling to my art. It's not even the close-ups and stuff. They're more span out. Well, I don't know how to explain it, but it's more of a detailed type art, and there's a lot of artists that do that, but not as many in the South as there is in the North. Most of the real detailed wildlife artists live in places where they get stormed in the wintertime and stuff like that, you know, where people become more of collectors.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I've seen your paintings, and they are very atmospheric. I love them. I think they are very evocative, and they bring out a very specific emotion when I look at it, and it's kind of mysterious, honestly. Now, you're very well known. I mean, I've seen your paintings in different websites and different places all across the Bigfoot world, as it were. So how did you get started with that? What was the thing that really draw you into Bigfoot and getting it, you know, portraying it the way that you do?
Well, I never really thought too much about doing abstract, and I've had a lot of people that were against it as friends, and so I moved kind of away from it and actually kind of drug cryptids along with it because, I mean, a person could consider a cryptid an abstract if it's just something that, you know, that's imaginary. But the cryptids, that's the question with cryptid creatures is whether or not they're real or not. But so to paint one realistically, I mean, you have to have either seen one or you have to have a pretty good knowledge of muscles, anatomy of most creatures in order to be able to assemble a viewing from another person. I haven't seen Loch Ness. I haven't seen Ocopogo. I haven't seen all the mystical creatures like the unicorns and stuff like that. But I have a pretty good idea what they all look like because I know the structure and the way the bones join together and the way muscle tissue joins together, you know, and the way fur lays on animals and the feathers patterns and the feather groups and stuff like that. And so when I've seen one, I think it was the first year was December, November of 2000.
You're talking about Bigfoot, correct?
Yeah. And I've seen one from a from where I see most of my wildlife is 20 feet up in a tree stand. I use these climbers, and I've made my own climbers before, but they basically latch onto a tree, and they allow you to kind of peg leg up the tree by jack motion, and you can get as high as 30, I've been as high as 30 or 40 feet in the forest up in these tall pine trees, but you can see all around, and it's quiet up there. Once you get up there, you don't have a tendency to move around a lot. I've been up in the tree from sunrise to sunset. I've watched the sun actually come up and go down from one position. And so, you know, I can tell you that's basically you're monitoring everything in that area. If something comes through there, they could possibly they could spot you and go around you, and that happens a lot. But once you've been doing it for a long time, you know, you get pretty good at it. And I practiced it with my dad. He taught me, and my uncles and my brothers, my cousins in northern Wisconsin taught me how to use these climbers. And basically, once you get up there, the world's pretty much, as long as you keep it wide open, you know, you can see what happens. Sometimes I'll poach I'll park it next to a stump or something, like a hawks and owls. They like, when they fly through the forest, they like to land on top of these broken off trees. And I'll take my camera along, and while I'm hunting, I'll take pictures of the hawks and the owls and stuff. But I started doing that, and that's when I seen the Bigfoot. And I was in denial for a good while. So many things were racing through my head. What if I shoot it? Well, I get in trouble. Well, the people will just kill me. And, you know, I had so many things racing through my head about this creature that I saw. And so my decision was that it wasn't something that you would want to shoot. And so I decided not to, unless it was a very last moment defensive type thing. But when I first saw this thing, I probably, you know, I was freaking out. I was probably a half an hour in dismay, all kinds of stuff running through my mind. And then how was I going to get out of there? This thing, wherever it was, knew me. It saw me because it hid from me. When it saw me, it hid from me, and I couldn't see it no more. So it's there, and it can see me easily enough. But, you know, I didn't know exactly what to do, if I should tell people when I get home. And so I finally, you know, after about 3 years, I started talking about it slowly, and I brought it up to other people and stuff, and I started, made a decision to start painting them. And so my first attempt at painting what I saw was, I don't know, it's like trying to call something and to get it exactly right was really hard for me to do, just the same way it was to do portraits. And so I started doing more portraits and started studying people and muscles and people's faces and stuff, and then using my recollection of what the Bigfoot looked like, I started putting it down on paper. It's really hard to do to get it exactly. It's always a mistake that I make. I'll go through all the facial muscles and everything and think I have it exactly right, but something's just still not exactly right. I could paint it again and still be even more pleased than I was the first time. Something's really hard to do for me, but some artists might not have been so hard to do. I mean, I can remember things like the length of the hair and the color and the basics of it and everything, but to actually bring out what that emotion of that was coming from that creature is what I wanted to capture, and that's what's really hard for me to capture, that same feeling, you know.
Yeah, of course. I mean, can you go into some details about that first encounter and, you know, what you saw and what you experienced?
Well, that first encounter was really blew my mind. You know, I I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to think. At first, I thought, when I first saw this thing coming up the hill, I thought I saw something black, and it was moving probably about 40 yards down the hill and coming up a ridge behind a long ridge that goes almost all the way to the river. This gap of woods actually joins down to the river, but I was on National Forest, which is up higher in elevation and more out of the valley onto the sides of the valley. So this thing was coming up the ridge, and it was about 40 yards away when I first seen it. And at first I thought it was a man walking, and then I looked closer, and the man had fur on his legs. I could definitely see the fur on his legs. And the next very thing that came in my mind was those chaps that the cowboys wear at the rodeo, only instead of being white or woolly yellow like they are most of the time, these were black, not brown, just black. And it was kind of hard to see the hair and fur, but I've definitely seen the hair and fur moving. And I could see like a browse line about waist high where the deer usually browse an area about 2 feet off the ground up to about 4 feet average in that zone. It's a little easier to see through the woods through that zone. Sometimes when I bend down in the woods, I can see a lot farther because I'm so tall. But what I was seeing was this creature walking with his head up in most of the leaves. So I was seeing glimpses of the top of this creature. And I leaned out, and more leaned out, and suddenly it saw me, and it stopped and looked right at me. And then the next thing I know, it took one step and disappeared. And I've had that happen to me before with animals. Is what they'll do is, especially the predators, coyotes and foxes, bobcats are well known for it. When they're approaching you and they see you, they'll immediately turn away and move away, but their eyes are such mounted on their head that they just have to tilt their head a little bit and they can see behind them. And so they're looking at you, even though they're not facing you, they have their eye peeled back, and they'll move away and they'll step behind the tree. They'll keep that tree in between you and them. If you go to the right to try to see around the tree, they'll step to the left. If you go to the left, they'll step to the right. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's like a football player zigzagging. They see you and they know you're trying to see them, so they want to keep that cover in between you and them. And that's how they do that. They disappear. They basically just disappear. You'll never see them again. If he can get out to a point where he can use enough cover, they're usually whatever it is you're studying, it's gone. You know, you'll never see it again. And I've had that happen to me all my life with black bears, foxes, and deer, and all kinds of animals do that. But I didn't know what – I was really scared when I first saw this thing, because all these years of knowing that it's a possibility it could exist, here it was right in front of me, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Then I started thinking that I was hallucinating. That, you know, I've heard people have stories of if they lose a loved one, or if they're stressed out at work or at home or something, they could actually hallucinate and imagine or see things, or even hear hallucinate, which is they hear things that aren't really there. They're just like a noise comes in your sleep, you know, it's not really there. And so I just kind of doubted my mind and, you know, turned it off. Well, it happened again. I've seen another one. And then it happened again a third time. By the time the third one hit, I was pretty much convinced that this was not something I'm just seeing. For some reason, I reached a point in my life where I started seeing really good, and I could feel through the woods and stuff more than what I normally or a normal person would be from spending so much time in the woods. And I was averaging 500, 600, 700 as a child. And then when I started working as a living, I still average 250, 300 hours in the woods every year. And that's being married.
That's amazing. I wish I could spend that much time in the woods.
That's being married and having stepchildren, two stepboys with my family. So I'm divorced now, but I live next to my family. My family's still with me. I just don't live in the same area as them, you know.
Okay, that makes sense.
But I don't know. Well, my family was with me when I seen one of the Bigfoot. And I'll never forget my wife. She said, what did I see? She asked me what I see. She said, it turned white like a ghost. My face turned white. And I told her I saw another one. And I was punching on my paddle to get up to where I saw it cross the road at. And I thought I saw it go behind a rock. And I looked later, after 16 years, I finally got enough gumption to go in there and look to see, because I thought I saw this creature run behind a big rock. And I went in there, and about the same exact spot where that was, there's two great big boulders with a log laying over top of it, right in the same spot where I saw this thing run. And I swear, I'm not making it up. It's on the map. If anybody wants to go look at it, they can go look at it, and I can even give you the location on the drive if you're interested in it. And you can go look at the area yourself. But it's funny, every time I go up there, something weird happens. Like a big sharp rock will be left in the middle of the road, or I'll hear something weird or smell something weird, you know. And it's really not very far from the Appalachian Trail. And the Appalachian Trail in some places is really human friendly. It's wide open. It's nothing really, doesn't look dangerous at all, but you go a few feet off the path and you can reach areas that's got caves and hollows and big rock slides and all kinds of stuff. You could get lost in a hurry if you turn the right path, you know.
There's a lot of reports from the Appalachian Trail, so that doesn't surprise me at all how close it was. When you had the first encounter, what were you doing in the woods? Were you hunting or were you just hiking? Can you like set up the initial stages of that first encounter?
That first encounter, I got to a point where I was getting discouraged about not knowing where the deer were going, because I would go hunting in the morning. What I would do is I'd go hunting in the morning before work, and then around time to go to work, or maybe a little bit late, I'd take off and go to work late. But I went to this place and eventually we started going at 3 in the morning, 2 and 3 in the morning. I went over there and it was like 3 a.m. when I saw the first sighting. And then the second time, eventually what happened was I would get into the woods early enough that I could hear the deer, which is correct. And I could hear, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I could hear the crunching in the leaves in the nighttime, and I could hear which direction the deer would be going. And so I'd go to the next place. And the next morning, I'd say, okay, well, the deer were crunching the other day. They were over on this ridge. And so I just kept moving closer to where I heard the sound. You know what I'm saying? Every morning when I went out to the spot.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. You're every day going towards what you're hearing, basically.
Yeah, and it's before hunting hours actually started, so I had my bow in a case, and I did everything legally and everything. I didn't have lights set up to shoot a deer illegally or nothing. I was just trying to find out where the deer were going through. How were they getting through without nobody noticing or knowing where they were at? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that is curious.
So that's how I discovered the first place that I've seen the thing. I don't know if that had anything to do with me being able to see it where other people weren't seeing it. You know what I'm saying? Maybe it did.
Well, maybe, I mean, it's because perfectly.
They just go out in the morning at 8 o'clock and they just go to a fixed spot and they stay there. And if that don't work, just try a different area the next day, you know?
Right. I mean, it's perfectly logical that you as a hunter would be able to see and detect things that most people wouldn't, because you're out in the woods and part of hunting is picking up on activity and signs of animals, so that way you can be a successful hunter. So I think that definitely lends a lot of ability to being able to pick up on these, especially these kind of creatures that people don't see very often.
Yeah, that's the best way to be able to find any rare animals that everybody is having a hard time finding, is to study and study them and hunt them longer or more hours than what they can. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because the general public, they don't have access. They don't have, maybe they don't think about it, or they don't use it. They don't use the knowledge of being able to do that. And so it goes undiscovered.
Right, exactly. It's a very plausible theory. I mean, there's a lot of animals that are just coming to light in the last few years that we had no idea existed, or new species and new, you know, there was, I think, a new monkey that just got discovered a few years ago that had never been seen or cataloged before. So that makes total sense. And I think that anyone, if they spend enough time in the woods and they really put a lot of energy into looking at certain signs and really looking for these things in almost like a detective type manner, then it might become easier for people to see them more often. But so that was your first sighting, and how long until your second sighting from that first one?
Yeah, it was after I picked up this new method of trying to find where things were going before anybody knew where they were going to, I started finding a whole lot more areas, you know, and I really wasn't bothered about going back to the same spot because I was kind of paranoid and I really didn't want to walk in the dark anymore, you know. I just figured there was only one of these things. I didn't think they were all over.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that a lot of people, when they first hear about Bigfoot, there is an assumption that there's only one of them. And once people realize how many there are, or how many people see them in different places, I mean, as far as I can have known, there's been sightings in every state, even in, you know, other countries. So I think that's a very common sort of initial misconception about them.
Yeah. So the second sighting was the same, pretty much as the first one, only it was in an area called Criders, back in the border of Criders, West Virginia and Virginia. But it was a road there that's closed to the public now. It was open when I lived in that area, and I went down that road early in the morning, did the same thing. And it was probably about the same time, amazingly enough. And that's what really awed me, was when I talked to the BFRO and they said it was kind of prophetic that I'd seen all these Bigfoots all in such a short period of time. And I told them, I said, yeah, it almost makes me want to lie about it because it sounds so unreal for me in my lifetime to have seen so many of them so close together at one time and then never see them again ever, you know. But it would have been easier to make it more believable if I could span them out over the years.
Well, how many years, how long, like when you first saw the...
Between 2000 and 2002, all three sightings.
Okay.
I do get confused between the third one and the second one sometimes because it all happened so close together. But once I developed this new method of discovery in the forest by going out real early when everybody else was still in bed, and then I seen the second one, and this was approximately 40 miles northwest of the other area. So it couldn't have been the same creature. It could have been, but it looked like the same creature. But it could So another thing I tell myself, maybe it was, maybe he did go that direction. You know, I just happened to see him again. Being trying to move away from it, I actually moved back toward where it was going. You know what I'm saying? It's like, instead of hiding and moving to a different place that doesn't have any Bigfoot, I ended up going maybe deeper into their territory than what I was before.
Oh, yeah, that's very likely.
And then so when that happened, I started getting really paranoid after that. I stopped going out early in the morning is what I usually did. I didn't have anybody to go with me, and I had some dogs come up missing, and I got to a point where my health got bad, and my back, and I had a bad accident and was crippled up for a good while, and I had a lot of troubles, so I hadn't been back and poured it on like I used to when I was younger, so I doubt I'll ever see one again, but I mean, it could be something that happened, but this one, and that's exactly what happened, more or less. I was on drive with my family, and I was looking down the road. This was not a tree stand or nothing. This was in a vehicle. And I was looking down the road, and I seen through the trees, kind of like the gaps of a video where you look off the side of the road and you can see between the trees. And I could see the road ahead of me, only it was way up around the bend, about 100 yards, maybe 125. And I seen what looked like a big dead tree between the road and the stone wall. And I thought to myself, that's odd. They don't normally allow trees to grow that close to the drive, either side of that stone wall. And so as we were moving, I picked it out almost immediately. I noticed that it wasn't changing positions as you go down. Sometimes you can see a little more clear, and then all of a sudden you can say, oh, look, it isn't beside the wall. It's down in the bottom a little bit. It just looked like it was beside the wall. But this thing dropped down. The tree that I thought was a tree had his hand up near his stomach like he was holding something. And he dropped down and shot across the road like a deer. I mean, he run like a deer, but it was huge. We're talking something that looks like a big old oak tree that's like 2 feet wide and 10 feet tall, you know, and across the road and two bounds. And it was up into the forest running, and I punched it. And I went around as I approached the area where I seen this thing is when I seen the foot go behind the rock. And then the last thing I seen was the bottom of its foot.
Okay.
But that sighting was entirely different from the way that I seen the other two creatures. And even the other two creatures were black. And this one that I seen on the drive was shaggy, like a woolly bear, dog type. Ever see those dogs? It's a wolf dog, whatever. Curly, like a poodle, but it's all matted and
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Kind of like that, wiry haired, I think they call them, but it was really big. And that's one that lived up on the drive. And I didn't question my mind that it was a Bigfoot. And that's why she started turning white. But, you know, I couldn't figure out why they forgot so fast. Because to me, it was a life-changing event. It was the third life-changing event that I've ever experienced on this planet. And they didn't even think nothing of it. I said, you remember the time we were up on the drive and seen that creature? She said, I don't remember that. I said, well, we talked about it when we were up there. She said, no. I asked the boys. They said they don't remember nothing about it. And I remembered this Indian, and I went studying that Indian stories and stuff about how they call them Oseha, which is to forget.
Okay, that's interesting.
Like a mental power. I don't know if they have a sound like an elephant. They reverberate from their lungs that it causes you to shut down your mind, your mental stability. You can't, just where you can't recall, almost like sleep. And the devil, you know, if you know anything about God and the devil, that's something that some people say the devil can make you do, is he can make you go to sleep. But that really baffled me. And after all that, I just decided I'd start painting as many different scenarios as I could of Bigfoot and different live actual events that I figured that he used to hunt with, like going underwater and pulling ducks down under the water and stuff that most creatures of prey would not think about how easy it would be to capture another predator if they used their brain, you know?
Yeah.
Like mountain lions, they just sit in a crouched position like your typical house cat and mouse thing, and they just jump on the deer when it goes by, but they don't have knowledge to know that some things would work easier than others until they get, you know, really old. But I got one, I call it the mallard hunter, where he puts the Bigfoot, puts swamp cactus and stuff on his head. You know, that's an actual hunting technique the Indians used. They would take pumpkins and squash and carve them out so they could see out into the water or above the water. And they'd take these mats of moss and mud and plop it on top of their head with grass, and they'd just sit there in the water. They'd put corn all around the bottom of the pond, and when the ducks would come by, they'd just grab them by the feet and pull them under the water.
Okay, so like using camouflage to, you know, to be hidden and come up by surprise.
Yeah, they tied to their belt, and the ducks would drown, and, you know, they'd get 20, 30 ducks. They'd go back to the camp and dump them off and go back and get more. You know, back in those days, when the Indians were here, the ducks were so heavy that they filled the dark in the skies.
Okay. Yeah.
But, yeah, Bigfoot, catching deer, stuff like that. I used to think, well, I'd be safe in my car. Believe me, if you're in... And I've seen a lot of Sasquatch movies. If they decide to kill you, that car does not stand a chance. This car does not stand any more chance than you do. The only thing that stopped me, saved you, is their lack of knowledge of how much faster it can get away if it can get to an area where it's a faster speed. Like, you know, out of the forest, you can get up, pick up speed like 40, 45. You get on the interstate, you can do 65, 85. Now, I don't think Bigfoot can run that fast, but you're not safe. If you're in a car and you're going down to a national forest at night, that car has no safety at all for you. It doesn't matter how big it is or how little it is. That thing was big enough, it can get you out of there.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Going back to the very first one you saw, how tall would you say it was?
The very first one was really not that huge. The size of the thing did not bother me as much as the power that it had. I'm 6'6", and I could paint a house by myself in a week, and I was a pretty strong guy, you know. But this thing was strong enough that it could come uphill and reach level area to where my parallel with my stand within a matter of minutes. And it would take me normally, like, from my, if I walk from the truck to my stand, you know, you're talking a half an hour or maybe longer. Plus, I got my stand, my gear with me, but I can't just walk through the woods, even though it's on my back and it's pack style on my back, and I can walk through the woods. I have to kind of dodge around branches at 6'6", and it's pretty slow moving uphill, maybe 1 mile an hour or less. But this thing, it's like glides through the forest like it's on steroids, and so powerful that it's just unbelievable. That's what puts the most fear in you, is not so much the size, but the size does have a lot to do with it, but it's the power of the thing, the strength of the thing.
Yeah, I've heard about them, the gliding motion.
Branches in the northwest, when it breaks branches, I'd be lucky if I can grab a branch with one hand, a balsam fir trunk, I'll be lucky if I can grab it with one hand at an inch wide and just snap it sideways. And these branches are up like 3-4 inches thick.
Yeah, branches are very thick. And I think when we hear about people hearing branches snapping in the woods, a lot of people don't realize the significance of that. But branches are thick. They're hard to break. I mean, if you can even do that.
But this up here, they're actually back breaking the trunk of the tree up in British Columbia and Mount St. Helens and places where it's really wild up in there. And they got a lot more stories and stuff. But their sightings of the breakings are like really powerful.
Yeah, one time, this was going back probably 2019. I took a friend of mine to an area in Maryland that has had a couple Bigfoot sightings. And one of the things that I look for are the stick structures, because when I was getting into Bigfoot, that was one of the ways that I was taught to tell if they're in an area or not. And what we saw was a fully grown, I think it was an oak tree, and it had been uprooted and turned upside down, so that way its roots were in the air, and its the top of the tree was dug into the ground. Now, I don't know if Bigfoot did that or not. I just know that that didn't happen naturally. I don't really think that a storm could have done that. I mean, something picked this thing up, turned it upside down, and then shoved it into the ground. So, I mean, I can understand exactly what you mean about how the power of them can be really fear-inducing.
Yeah, I've seen people do it, and there was actually a guy that lives here in Virginia. If you go by his property, he's got a lot of them out in the field. They're upside down, the roots are in the air, and it looks crazy. I mean, it looks crazy. It looks sinful, but everybody says he's a witch or this and that. But if you look at his trees, the bark's been removed. You can see where heavy equipment's been used and the straps and everything where they grabbed it to turn it upside down. But these trees have been turned upside down, stuck in the ground, and they don't have no mechanical damage or nothing on. There's no, even some of them still have the rotten wood adhering to it, where they just picked it up and just stuck it in one big jam like a knife, and it didn't even hurt the bark of the tree, you know?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
It was really, really awesome to be around something. An elephant would compare, no matter what size they are, and they're really big, but they're a lot more mentally down the ladder than a Bigfoot. But I'm not saying the elephant's stupid, because they do have a good memory. They are different, and they're not worried about hiding from anybody. But they, the same feeling you get when you get around an elephant, that big, massive breath and stuff that you hear. Like the time I was in Colorado, I'm not sure if it was a mule deer or what it was, but it was pitch black, and I was hitchhiking from Aspen to Glenwood Springs. And this thing startled me. It broke through the rocks, and it was so massive, and the breath coming out of his lungs, and it was only a few feet away, 10, 15 feet. And I froze. I just froze instantly. I always felt like a big rabbit. But then I figured the wisest thing for me to do, even if it was a grizzly bear or a black bear, would be to just slowly move on my path on the side of the road away from it. And so that's what I did. I started walking again, and it stayed where it was and let me leave. But I'll never forget that, the power of that thing. It's like a big barrel drum. When you hear something that big breathing, it sounds like a barrel.
Oh, yeah, like, no, I know what you mean. Yeah, the sound can be just as fear-inducing as seeing one. I know a lot of people who've never seen one, but they hear them, and the power of the screams and the noises and the eeriness of it all, they won't go back into the woods just because of the sound. And so I've never seen one. I can't even imagine what it feels like to actually see one in the flesh. When you saw the first one, you said that it saw you. Did you notice any kind of facial features? I mean, was it surprised to see you? Was it angry? I mean, what would you say the demeanor of it was when you saw it?
Well, the eyes did show a little white, not much. And they were black. They didn't show red or anything, but they were out. They were bulged. They weren't recessed like an old man.
Yeah.
They were kind of bulged and almost like some of the Chinese people have, where it doesn't appear to have much of an eyebrow, or the eyelids are almost like one big piece. There's no eyelid, but the brow on, even though the eyelids were like that, and the brow was still evident, that had the sloping forehead dished out a little bit above each eye on each side of its head, and the crest had a definite pattern of a crest, almost like a duck's breast would have when you pluck it. But you could see the muscle in the head, and if you hit one of them upside the head, you probably know where even close to the skull, because I would imagine there's at least 2 inches of flesh on both sides of its head that surrounds the brain, you know?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
It's just the thing, and it's really might not be any reason to be afraid of it, but it's just so strong and so powerful. The fear, when it got in me, that's what was the most impressive thing, to see it coming up the hill without breathing, without apparently having much effort to it.
Well, I think that when you bring up, you know, there may not be any inherent reason to fear them. They may be completely benevolent beings. Yeah. But when people see them, it's not like they are seeing a bear or seeing a cougar. When you see a bear or a cougar, I mean, you're afraid for your life, but it doesn't stay with you the same way when people see Bigfoot. It seems to affect them in a much deeper and fundamental way than just seeing a normal animal.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think the reason why is because if the Bigfoot were to collaborate and join hands and be able to describe what we are and who we are, they could hunt us down. You know, they could actually find out, well, according to where I was and where I was hunting, you know, they could get together and possibly figure out that I lived on the other side of the valley near another patch of woods that would be nothing for them to come down and just tear right through my house.
Oh yeah. I mean, we know that they're
don't have no neighbors. And,
yeah. We know that they're intelligent. We know that they have extremely high thinking capabilities. And that's a very plausible theory. I mean, if they did decide to join up together as a group and come after people, and I don't want to say that I know this for a fact, but I feel like I've heard stories about people shooting one and then multiple coming back for revenge. They do seem to have this strong revenge streak in them. So that implies, well, it implies a lot, but it implies coordination and problem solving and things like that. And so it's very, I mean, we know that these things are much smarter than your average bear.
They can survey. We know that they can survey because the sightings, if you look at the sightings, the pen marks on the maps, the database shows that they're following evident trails and areas from one woodland to the other woodland areas. And so, you know, there are surveyors, so there's no way they can walk that kind of distance and not know what they're looking at. They have to know what they're looking at.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
This tree and that rock shape and this river creek here turns here and approximately 50 feet past that one. They might not have known measurements, but they just remember it for how it is, for what it really is, you know?
I've heard a lot of people say that they follow the electrical lines, like the big power lines in the woods.
Well, I think that's more of a, just a favorite thing because that draws a lot of deer and game. The reason why is because the deer are what they call they got a name for succession animal. Their best habitat for a deer is succession, which grows from the trees into the field. It's a field edge animal. And high wires provide field edge everywhere they go. There's two, one on one each side. Plus, they have different diversity within the high wire itself, crossing the usually Jeep trail or whatever, and it makes it easy for them to travel longer distance. You know, like they can run full out, and they can just run right over top of the mountain.
Right. Yeah. So you described the first one and the second one, and the second one was it ran across the road in front of you, right?
Yeah.
What was the third one like? Can you describe that whole scenario?
That one was hunting from the tree stand. I'd gotten where I was trying to shoot a deer so that the deer would roll down the hill. I got tired of dragging them long distances. So I started setting up my hunting scenarios so I could go up to a bank and figure where the deer were hunting or were living. And then when I made my shot, the deer would run towards the truck and die, you know, so I could. Most of my average deer kills, deer collapses within 50 yards of the vehicle. My top record is 25 feet so far. And these are national forest hunted animals. These are not animals that are living a pressure-free life in a game farm with big racks. They're a wild creature. Their deer are real little. Their horns don't typically get real big. Closer to the road they are, the less chances of them surviving, but there's a lot of them. And so I started doing that, and I went to West Virginia doing that, trying to get the deer to collapse closer to the truck. And the same thing happened to me again. I seen one almost as identical that I did the scene over here near Elkton, Virginia, only that was back at Crider's. And it was black legs, same way. And I told myself the same thing again. This has got to be a bear. And it's not the cowboy with the furry legs again. And so I looked, and sure enough, it was tall. It didn't go long ways like a bear does. And so I watched it. And I think what's happening when I was watching these things was I was leaning out, and I don't know if the tree would creak or the stand would creak, because I don't remember the sound happening, but I know my stand does creak if I lean on it, but I don't remember making any sound. But it's possible they heard my stand creak, and they saw me and turned and hid from me and ran and got behind the trees and moved away in this rapid-like manner. I was telling you about how they run with the one eye sticking out the side of their head. They can see behind them as you run. They keep the cover between you and them, so you can't get the shot, whether it's a camera shot or a rifle shot. You can't get the shot. It's just gone. And I did shoot, and I did get my deer in the area. I beat a record there. I think when I came to my truck and I went to load the deer, I crossed over one pile of dirt, and there the deer lay. It was 15 feet. That was one place that I got closer to 25 yards. It was a spike buck, but it was about 15 feet from the back of the truck.
Well, that's a great record.
Yeah, that's when I started hunting. I got tired of running all over, and I was just shooting for food. I wasn't shooting for pleasure or for trophies. There's nothing wrong with trophy hunting. I encourage it. Trophy hunting is what keeps us alive. It's what keeps the deer alive. The sponsorship that comes from trophy hunting in the USA is unreal, and that is what keeps the game going. The Ducks Unlimited, Wild Turkey Federation. I always encourage everybody, if you want to have a better natural world where the game is managed properly, buy a hunting license, buy a fishing license. Even if you don't hunt and fish, buy one, because that does support the local officials to try to keep the riffraff and the... There's a few people that hunt for food because they're hungry, and I don't really hold nothing against them. If they can shoot a deer without buying a hunting license, more power to them. If they got to feed their family and they have to do it and they don't want to spend the $20 or whatever, I hold nothing against them. I don't sponsor them. I don't encourage it. But the people that bother me are the ones that buy the hunting license and they have these rifles they buy. They have to use the rifle. The rifle's got to be used, and they use it, and then they throw most of the meat away, or they don't even carry it out. They just cut the head off and leave the rest lay, and which it goes back to the animals. And even with that, I don't hate those people. I just think it's despicable for a man to buy a $500 rifle and then feel like he has to kill something with it, because it's otherwise it's a waste of time, you know?
Yeah, I know. I agree with your sentiment on that. I think that's there's something really wrong with that. But, you know, I've always found that hunters and the hobby of hunting is one of the most environmentally friendly, and they seem to be the most environmentally conscious, because, you know, if your passion is deer hunting, you want as many deer as possible to be able to do it. And so yeah, the fact that these hunting licenses and these federations, you know, even though you're buying it to hunt, the money that you're spending goes towards the protection of these animals and keeping them out in the wild. So that's I find that to be a very good cause. But the Bigfoot that you saw that third time, can you describe it a little bit? Well, you know, what it was doing and how it reacted? I guess you said it saw you, right?
Yeah, it was pretty much an exact repeat of the first one. It was moving up the hill, and I seen it, and I just replayed it through my mind exactly like I seen before. Only it was a little bit farther away, but the woods were more wide open. There wasn't as much brush. It was just a little bit farther away, and it was pretty much in the same kind of a scenario in the forest where I had a little valley in front of me between it and me, so I had less trees and leaves, like an opening in between me and it, in the woods where the forest dips down. And so it was pretty much the same way. Once it saw me, I leaned forward, it got away from me, and I did the same thing. I just stayed up in the tree for as long as possible before I realized, and then I just... That's what most people probably have done that before. Say, if it's in the dark, you don't want to get out in the dark. But if it's going to be dark, you better get down before it gets dark.
Yeah. Well, so all your sightings have been daytime sightings, or have they been nighttime?
Yeah, they're daytime. This is the one that I've seen. The first one, I don't mean to confuse you, but I was there at 3 a.m., 2 and 3 a.m., and I heard the deer go through, and I pretty much was right on top of them that day. That day was one of the days when the deer, I could hear them breathing and running and snorting, and their feet hitting the ground and everything. And that's really something to go through. Even if you're on the ground and you lay down on the ground and hide in the leaves and let them run past you, there's really something to experience. But, and I've heard stories of people saying that's happened to them with hundreds of deer, where they just all moved through at one time, you know. But the deer had gone through, and this was about the same time. It was about 9 a.m., somewhere around that area, 9 a.m. That's what I remember. The first, second, and the third was all in the morning. The one that I saw in the tribe was a little bit before noon, because we were going to a noon picnic at noon.
Okay.
It was about 11. And the one up on the drive is entirely different. This thing was like a hippie. I mean, it had hair coming down over its head. Just like, you couldn't even see its face. I couldn't see its eyes. I could see its arms and its hand in front of its stomach. And I could see its stomach and its forelegs. The thighs were massive. And the shoulder, you know, was kind of hidden from the long hair from the head. But at the same time, you could, there was enough bulk there. It almost looked like a big pile of hay. And that when people refer to it as a big pile of hay, I know what they're saying, because there are certain types that are bigger and longer hair on them for some reason. I think it might have something to do with the way they move through the forest, but you take a creature that's black, the black ones, and you put them in the mountain laurel and you have them moving through the mountain laurel real fast, their fur is going to be combed and pulled. But if you take the long-haired ones, they're real massive, they move real slow like a moose up high in the blueberries and a little more open laurel. They're not running and ripping their hair all to shreds. They're maintaining this messed up mat all over their body where it's full of leaves, and even, you know, birds could nest in it, make a nest in it, and they wouldn't care. Who knows? But the black ones are more, what I think, they look like in northern Quebec, Canada, up in the tree lines where it's all evergreens. And laurel, the gnarly laurel here on the sides of the mountain is so thick, you can become trapped in it. I've been trapped in it several times, and one time I was stung severely by bees, and I couldn't get out, and they really tore me apart. But it's real gnarly and tough. You can't break it. And if you don't go back exactly what hole you went through, you make a wrong turn, you end up getting yourself tore up, and it does break. And once it breaks, it's sharp, it cuts you. Mountain laurel. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. I can't stand it.
It's a major food source for deer in the winter in the mountains.
Yeah.
Up above a certain level. Most mountains here have a level. If you look off in the distance and you look at the ridges, there's almost looks like a fire road of a certain level. And then above that is mountain laurel. And then above that is evergreens.
Well, one of the things when I go out into the woods, whether I'm looking for Bigfoot or just hiking, the thing that scares me the most is ticks. I have like an overwhelming fear of ticks because, you know, some of them can get real small and you can't find them. And Lyme disease is no joke. I know a few people who've had it and still have it. And it's not a fun time. And that's what I'm most alert for when I'm out in the woods. I mean, aside from looking for Bigfoot as ticks, I can't stand it.
Yeah, well, you know, I spent so much time in the woods, I believe that I have become immune to a lot of that stuff. But like when I was a boy, I used to walk in a lot of swamps. I lived in the South several times in my life, and I would make turtle traps and walk in the swamps with my shoes. I never used waders or nothing. I would duck hunt, and if I shot a duck, I would go out in the water and get it. I wouldn't put no waders on or nothing in the wintertime. And that's the way I was. And I believe I became immune to either that, or for some reason these parasites attacked me so badly that my body developed a resistance to them. And I don't have never, as far as I know, I should have had Lyme disease by now, but I don't know that I haven't, and I've never been tested for it, and I've never come up tested positive. My son has here recently in the summer, and they say other people have had it. They say it can do wreck havoc with different people in different scenarios and stuff. Some people, they get mentally really off in their mind from it, but like almost a, we call it, like the president, I forget what you call it, almost older people get it a lot.
Dementia
that makes you, that's what happened to me when I had my accident. I get, every once in a while, I get that old person's problem. But my brain, if a raccoon has, and I've seen these parasites in these animals because I've skinned them out. I did taxidermy work for years. And if I have parasites, my brain is probably full of brain worms and blood worms and all kinds of stuff in my muscle tissue, you know, from being in the same habitat. I've seen a liver fluke in a deer that thing was 8 inches long.
Wow, and that's huge.
Every now and then, I feel something moving inside of me, and I swear it's not part of me, but I haven't gained a fear of it or nothing. I figured maybe it might help me survive a little longer by eating dead tissue and stuff that's not supposed to be there. Maybe it would actually help.
Maybe. That's definitely a possibility. When you...
ticks, if you want to repel ticks, a good tick repeller, there's some herbal remedies and stuff, plants that you can make. Tinctures, they call it, and then you just add that to Vaseline, and you can take a pair of socks and cut the foot off and pull it up real high on your leg, and you can take a tincture on there and Vaseline, so that if a tick comes off of your sock and tries to crawl up into your pant leg, it hits this barrier, and it turns around and usually goes back and falls back off.
Okay, well, I should try that, because that I could definitely do that, and
same thing. I used to wear them all the time. They're like bands, wristbands, and you can impregnate the repellent and stuff, whatever you use, on that band, and you can slide it up under your shirt where nobody even knows you have it.
Yeah, no, that's my fear is, I check myself for ticks whenever I come home from the woods, but it's the one that you can't see, or it's somewhere that you wouldn't normally look, and that's the one that gets you. And so I'm very obsessive when I get back from the woods. I'm just checking myself constantly, taking a shower, trying to scrub every part of me just to make sure that doesn't happen. When you saw that third Bigfoot, and I'm assuming that's the last time you've seen one, correct?
The third one, yeah, was the last one that I've seen.
What was going through your mind when you saw that one? Because you were, from what I understand, you were in the deer stand. You're a bow hunter, correct?
Yeah.
So you had your bow, you were in the tree stand, you see this massive thing coming up on you. What was going through your mind?
It was the same repeat of the first one that I've seen. I could not believe it. And that's what I was telling you about when I contacted the BFRO, and they told me they thought that was prophetic, like a message from God or something, because of the way that I seen them. And there was actually a purpose in it in my life in order to get through my life, you know?
Oh, yeah. And then I think that a lot of people feel that way when they see one.
As many times as I've been in the woods, it would be kind of sad if I had spent all this time here and never had seen one, because you would expect it. You would expect that I had reached a goal or a point in my life when I could actually go in the forest and find one for you. And I can now. I can take you into some places where you can pick up a smell. I can't guarantee a sighting, because that's not something I can control, but I can take you into the area where you can look for tracks, and you can smell the smells, and you can decide for yourself if you feel safe in there by yourself, you know.
Did you smell anything when you saw any of these? I mean, I know that a lot of people report kind of like a scent of death or like wet trash, like a real putrid kind of smell.
Yeah, most of what I smell reminds you of a dog that's been rolling in his own feces and with fresh flowers.
Oh, that's interesting. So there's an air of fragrance to it.
Yeah, it's almost like you smell it and it's a sweetness to it. It's fresh, but it's not. At the same time, it does have a little bit of a putrid rottenness to it. It's all those flavors in between. I don't know if they use their own feces as a calling card to each other so they can tell who's coming through the woods. And then maybe possibly they're smearing themselves down with some type of plants and stuff that they've been eating that smells sweet.
Kind of like a signal to others that they're in the area.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it. I mean,
that's an interesting theory, though.
They know each other, then they would know who was coming, because they know how that person is. Just like you and me, if you ate a lot of hot dogs and I smelled a hot dog and I would think of you, And if I ate a lot of steaks, barbecue steaks, and you smelled barbecue steak before I came around the corner, you would think of me, you know?
Oh, yeah, like association by smell. Yeah, I've heard of that, and I've experienced it myself. When you, in these cases, when you've seen these Bigfoot, did you smell them before you saw them, or was it all simultaneously?
I've smelled things in the past that I couldn't correlate, and I don't know. I passed off as a skunk. I passed off as a possum. I passed it off as whatever, and don't even think about it no more. But after I seen the Bigfoot, I start correlating the smell to what was happening. Like when my dog came up missing, and the scent in the area was so strong, and that dog never barked. If he got hung up in the brush, he sat still, he froze, and he hid. He may have gotten away and ended up with some other hunter, but I have a feeling that the Bigfoot found him and took him, you know.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I know, you know, for me, dogs are pretty special.
And
so
that's when I had the smell, like the smell that I smelled on the highway. I was telling you about the big barrel sound.
Yeah.
I don't remember smelling that dog, that wet dog scent there, but I knew I could smell something big. There was an odor. There was a different odor in the wind, you know. And then maybe why it didn't bother to follow me, because it couldn't see me and it couldn't smell me that well. Maybe the way the wind was blowing and it didn't bother me. But you take a bear, and that's happened here actually. I was going from my neighbor's house and I didn't smell it. I don't remember smelling it, but it was big and it stood up. And when it stood up, you could hear it. Mouth growling, making like a slobbery growling sound.
Oh, okay. So there was sound with it.
Yeah, it was when it was moving along the side of the road, it almost sounded like a jogger running down low. And then when it raised up, you could hear it like it was slobbering. And my friend, he said this is a big old bear coming down the road, but I never seen nothing. I was on my bike and I pedaled as hard as I could to get up to the next lane where my house was, to get up to the lane, you know. This one certain spot there by my house, if there's no moon out, it just gets so dark you can't see your hand in front of your face.
Yeah, I've been in the woods when there's been no moon out, and it is pitch black.
Yeah.
When, so after these sightings, how long was it before you decided to start painting them?
It was a good 4 years, four years. And it was even longer than that before I decided to go back to any of the areas where I saw them. I started painting them in 04. I didn't go back into the first area that I saw one where it went behind the rock was in 2016. I had a bad accident in 2010 that crippled me, disabled me, where I can't keep up with workers. But they and that's what slowed me down a lot. But during that period of time, 6 years it took me to heal, I finally started moving around and I found myself curious about my past. And a lot of things I was thinking, I could watch an interview and it said that don't look the creature in the eye, because if you do, you only have 7 years to live.
Really? I've never heard that, but that's interesting. Kind of like a curse?
Yeah, she's the Indian woman. So this caretaker of the forest, and if you see one, look down. Don't look it in the eyes. And actually, I found that's helped me in a lot of scenarios, but even when I go to court, it seems like it helps. I don't look the judge in the eye. I look down.
Maybe it's just kind of like a respect thing. I mean, they want, you know, these are pretty supreme beings. I mean, if they've been around for time immemorial and no one seemed to be able to find them or prove that they exist. I mean, people see them all the time, but they're so elusive and there's so many... there's a lot of weird stuff connected to them. It doesn't give me the impression that these are just undiscovered apes, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and then what really struck me as odd is, I thought, well, maybe I had my accident because I did look the thing in the face. It was about the right amount of time that I seen the first one. And then it was a year after 911, and the accident that I had that almost killed me was a day on 911, but it was the month after, I think, or something like that. But it was a little bit different. But I remembered my accident date by 911. It was 10-1-1. That's what it was.
Okay.
It was 10-1-1. And then went by the house the other day, still thinking it's really weird the way it happened, and noticed that the house number is 19111.
Okay. So there's some it's like synchronicity
Twilight
here.
Zone. Yeah, the Twilight Zone starts coming up.
Yeah, I mean, people say that there's have a lot of synchronicities and just very strange coincidences when they see one or they hear, you know, when they experience it, other parts of their life get weird. That doesn't surprise me at all that something like that would happen after seeing three in such a short amount of time.
Yeah, and there is a lot to do with numbers in our life. Even the Bible states that God controls some things and movements in our own lives with numbers. And he has favorite numbers, you know. And so numbers do have an effect on us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, numerology's been around for a long time. So that lines up with that. When you've been out in the woods since you've had experiences, have you experienced other things such as, you know, how they say, you know, wood knocks and whoops and things like that? Or has it been pretty quiet since those experiences?
No, before I even acknowledged that they existed, I had a lot of experience of screams, strange screams, and some of the screams, I can still make them verbally, but one may be a barred owl, and one may be an actual barn owl. I'm not sure, but I've heard screams, wild screams. One time I got out, it was pretty crazy. I got out on the National Forest Road at night, and I got out and I walked around my vehicle. I had at that time, I had a 1969 Nova. And I walked out behind the car and I walked up to the ledge, the edge of the road where I could see down in the valley over to the other side. It's pretty isolated back there, what they call Coburn Road. And this thing screamed to the top of its lungs. It sounded like a lady that had just been stabbed, and she was just hysterical. And it was just really long. It really scared me. I took off. I dropped whatever I had, and I was in the car, and I was going down the road. That's what one of the things I was telling you about is you think you could be safe going down the road. I felt safe at the time driving away, even if I was doing 35 or 40 on this mountain road. But that thing can run right up to you and just flip your car right over, break your door and pull you out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's been cases of people almost getting dragged out of their cars by these things, or they thought they were going to be.
One guy, I watched the video the other day, he was pulled over in his van, and one of them came and rocked his van while he was in it. He said he was bouncing around all over inside the van. He saw the thing, saw its eyes, its chest, and then suddenly it stopped and went on. But the thing is just when it goes through your mind, you don't know what to do. You just follow suit, just like you, any animal, I guess, fear for its life. You want to get away, but you can't. And he couldn't because he was stuck after it left. He was stuck in his van. All he could do was sit and wait, you know, for his buddy to come back.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it puts you in a very powerless position where, you know, you can't leave, you don't know what to do. One of the things that people say, especially hunters when they see them, is that they say they have a very human-like face. Is that how you would describe the face of what you saw, or were they more animal-like?
Yeah, from what I've, the quality of my sighting and the hair, and from what I saw, I see, and what I see is what I saw in my mind, and that's what I only thing I could tell you is what I pictured was that, like a horse. I mean, a horse. You look at a horse's nostrils; they're receded and they're folded down. But if you take that same horse and run him around the ring, and his nostrils full wide open, blazing fury with the big circles.
Okay, well, so are you saying that these things kind of had like flared nostrils when you saw them?
They can. That's what I'm saying is they have the ability to relax, and the hair and the nose and the nostrils look more like ours. I don't think they have a dog look curl on it. But at the same time, I could be wrong because I couldn't see that well underneath of there. But that could be that their nostrils open up a whole lot more when they're moving. Because the one that I saw moving did appear to have larger nostrils than the other one. But then the one on the drive, I couldn't see his face hardly at all. So I couldn't tell you. But I don't remember seeing a button nose. I don't remember seeing a cheekbone. All it was a gnarly, messed up hair you ever seen in your life.
That sounds really terrifying. So when you saw it, it was more animal-like? I mean, you wouldn't... When you saw it, did you think it was... I mean, you said it, you thought it was a man at first, right?
Yeah.
At least the first one?
Yeah. And the power and the speed of the creature, I thought the first thing I could think of was man or man-like. But at the same time, I wouldn't call it an animal. It looked to me like an alien. Almost like an alien you would see from outer space, if you was to put a belt on it and a satchel and clothes and stuff, it would appear to be an alien. You know, give it a ray gun and run it through off of a spacecraft, you know, it would be acceptable to be a hairy alien. But our idea of an alien is bald. You know, they got the big head, the big eyes, which that's what they call the grays.
Right, the grays.
They got this big, well, triangular, big, huge head, and then there's tall ones, and then there's the small ones. But I had another incident that I never have been able to figure out. It could be Bigfoot related, but when I put my roof together on my house, I used what do you call it? 5-grand rib, 16-foot-long sheets. And I put this 5-grand rib on top of my trailer and on top of my non-existent an addition that I built, and I used 8x10s, treated lumber. And I put these sheets of steel on my roof, and you know, something got up there, reached down underneath of the top piece of overlap that's at the ridge line, reached under there, grabbed that metal that was underlapped under the other piece of metal, and pulled it out in such a manner that you could, when you was on the roof, you could look down and see the trailer underneath of there, inside there. It was a hole probably about as big as a football, but, and I looked for blood, I looked for signs of hair, I couldn't find none, and never been able to figure it out. The screws were ripped straight out of the wood, and there was no sign of a crowbar being used, no fingerprints. I could not figure that out. I still haven't been able to figure that out this day. What? Why would something try to go down through the roof when everybody knows it was a trailer that had two roofs? You had to go through one roof, you had to go through another roof anyway, so it would be easier just to go through the front door.
Yeah.
But that's really baffled me to this day. I've never been able to figure that one out.
That's crazy. So you're saying something.
I took it all apart. I had to take 5 sheets of grand rib off before I could get it on, because I had to underlap them in the top piece before I could get all together and then put all the screws back. I had to take like 3 or 4 sheets apart to get it back.
So you're saying something came up on your roof and ripped it up. So that way there was a hole going, like, so you could see from inside the trailer outside from your roof.
Yeah, and didn't damage the tin at all. It, you know how you lay one piece of tin down, then you lay the next piece of tin over top of it.
Yeah.
And you put two screws in there in that seam. You put that rubber, I put that rubber bonding tape in between the two pieces of metal and put the screws down and then put the overlap beam on top, the very top. And whatever it was went up there and it reached down underneath of the top piece and grabbed the bottom piece of tin and pulled it up about a foot, enough where I could see in there, and then let go of it. And that's the way it stayed for several months or maybe a year before my brother-in-law noticed it and pointed it out to me. And I went up there and looked at it and couldn't figure it out.
Did you hear anything on your roof? I mean, did you...
We hear stuff a lot, but we don't never suspected anything up there, you know, because it's in the woods, it's branches and stuff that blow through.
Yeah, of course.
And owls and hawks still land on the roof sometimes, but this was really baffled me, and I can still show you there's no scratches on the paint whatsoever, and it was popped up in such a manner that the bottom piece held the top piece up in the air. And then at the top of each piece of tin held the top flap open at the top. And that's all the screws were popped out and gone. And then, you know, it was just sitting there open, but not torn. Not a piece of tin was damaged. It wasn't a cut or shred, a scratch on any of it. It was just popped open, almost like trying to dissemble something the wrong way.
So it was very careful in how it took this thing apart. I mean, it didn't just try and shred through it like an animal.
Yeah. It was almost like something had the ability to push out and pull up at the same time without hurting itself because there wasn't any blood. If anything of this world would have reached in between all that tin to pull the bottom piece up,
they'd probably cut themselves or something.
Yeah, it would have cut itself. But there was nothing there. Almost like it was either mechanically done with some kind of technology that we don't know of these days, or the creature is so strong and the skin is so tough that it doesn't get cut like we do.
Yeah, that it very well could be. So the three sightings that you've had, have they all been in the same area or areas close to each other, or are they more spread out?
One to give you, if you want to look at it on map, it's called Hensley Hollow. The overlook is mile marker 65. It's just past the Hensley Hollow overlook on the right. You can take the same path I took and look through the trees and see up the road heading northbound from Hensley Hollow. There's two overlooks in that area, but you go past the Hensley Hollow overlook and look to the left through the trees and you can see the road over on the other side of the valley. And then you go around the curve. At the mile marker and actually look up in the woods and still see the two boulders that are sitting there. And the area where I think this creature lives is just past that. It's rough terrain. It's hard to get to. If you was up on the drive, you could just walk right on top of it and not even know you passed it. But because it's kind of level up there on the drive where the trail is, you know, it's forest up there. Flat.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
But you can walk right past it. You wouldn't even know you passed this area. But you come down to where I was, to where the road is at, where actually Skyline Drive Road is at, you come down the hill, it's pretty rough. You have to have, you don't even want to get crampons on your shoes to keep them sliding down the hill.
Okay, so it's pretty rough terrain and slippery.
Yeah.
Well, you know, sometime I would love if me and my friend Alden, who does the show with me, could come down and you could show us where it all happened and we could do kind of like an on-site investigation for ourselves and see if we experience anything.
Yeah, and if you look at the Virginia map, that first location was the second sighting. We'll call it the second one.
Yeah.
If you look straight across the valley onto what's called Runkle's Gap Road and the George Washington National Forest, it used to be a shelter up there called Boone's Run, but it had been destroyed. It's gone now. And that ridge line that runs behind the Mashinaw Mountain Hunting Club, the shooting range, that's the same ridge that thing traveled on to get to the point where I was at. All trees are grown up now there. It used to be when I saw it, all of those trees behind that shooting range were just young saplings. They were only an inch or so thick. But now they're trees everywhere, you know.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And then the other sighting, if you go even farther heading west, just head kind of to the north about 30, 40 miles back into where 211 exits Virginia, and you'll see some townships called Folks Run and Criders and Burton. Burton is where I was, where it's a place called Camp Run, where the men used to hide from the Civil War. They would go up in there and they call it Camp Run.
Okay. I'm going to look on the map and see where I can, if I can find it. And yeah, I'd love it if you could be our guide and show us these areas and see if we could maybe, you know, experience something ourselves. So, Mike, where can people get more information on you and your paintings?
BigfootPaintings.com. I'm all over the internet. I studied a lot when I was bedridden from my accident. That's the only friend I had for years, besides my family at that time, but my ex-wife and my stepsons. But that computer saved my life. It kept me alive, you know, and a lot of people are against them, but I have a lot more knowledge of them than most people do. Just from having my accident, I've managed to accomplish a lot of things that a lot of my friends don't understand. And most people underutilize their phones, like drop pin. I can send somebody a drop pin, they can immediately see where I'm sitting. And, you know, stuff where you don't realize, you tell somebody that, and it just doesn't manage in their head. How can you do that? But if you have a phone and you have maps on your phone, mine has maps, mine correlates to yours, and yours gobbles mine up, and next thing you know, you can look all over the area where I'm sitting at. You can zoom out and see what county I'm in and what big city I'm near. You can, you know, there's a lot, so much you can do with phones these days, but people are resisting them. They're old timers, and they don't want to see new technologies succeed. And it is used for evil purposes. I understand that it's good and bad and all that stuff, but we might as well try to build it for the best we can and try to make the good out of it. But you go to BigfootPaintings.com, or just Google my last name, or Bigfoot, MJW Bigfoot. I have several secondary names. I do stock carvings and pistol grip carvings. I'm a real big fan on Ruger pistol grips on Facebook. People like my pistol grips. Imitation make mammoth grips, and ivory and stag, I make imitation grips for the revolvers. And so I've got a lot of fans on that, but I get likes on that every day. But you'll see my pages anywhere online if you Google my last name. My nephew Will is helping me a lot, and so you may reach him, and he may reach you, but most of the time he just forwards all of it to me, and he does work for me and helps me a lot on my sales and keeping up with the customer responses and stuff, so we can get people taken care of on the BigfootPaintings.com.
Well, that's awesome, Mike. And I'm going to link all of your stuff in the show notes tonight once we're finished this interview. I know that your nephew, who I just call the Wizard because that's how he likes to be called, he does all the artwork for the show, for the podcast. So I know that your family's pretty talented. So, Mike, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your stories with us. And I would love to have you back on and maybe even come down there where you are, and you can show us where some of this stuff happened, and we can see what happens to us. So, Mike, thank you so much. And I just want to say how nice it has been to have you on.
Oh, I appreciate it. It was a pleasure. It's amazing how much you get run out of time, you know, and you feel like you could just go on and on forever. But
oh no, I know what you mean, and I'm
good things, you know.
I'm absolutely going to have you. I'm definitely going to have you back on for more episodes in the future.
Yeah, and I was glad to be able to talk. I know sometimes I feel like I might be a little more than what most people can accept the first time they hear me, but most of the time, as I talk more and more to people, they understand. They seem to understand. I've never run into anybody that just didn't flat out call me crazy.
No, I don't think you're crazy at all. I think you're very lucid, actually. But
it used to be at one time, it was that way when I was a kid. There were a lot of people were done that way. You know, anybody that came up with it, they just automatically just start teasing them.
Yeah. No, you seem, I've really enjoyed your stories, and you're a great storyteller, and you've given so much detail about your accounts, and I think it's going to be a real pleasure to people listening. So I want to thank you so much, and I want you to have a good night, okay?
Yep, good night.
All right, bye.
Bye.
And that was my discussion with Mike Worthnick, the painter and Bigfoot experiencer. I really like talking with Mike, and I'm very excited to have him back on the show, and hopefully Alden and I can get down there to where he is in Virginia and scope out the area and see if we can have any experiences there ourselves. All of his links will be in the show notes below, and with that, we bid you adieu. Have a good night, folks, and see you next time on Strange Dominions Podcast.